Okay, this sutta tonight is one that has caused quite a stir when I found this in the Samyutta Nikaya, because the standard way of practicing loving kindness that I learned through the Visuddhimagga is that loving kindness will take you to the third jhana. Compassion will take you to the third jhana. Joy will take you to the third jhana. Equanimity will take you to the fourth jhana. And that's what an awful lot of people believe. Now, this particular sutta is from the Samyutta Nikaya. It's the Bojjhanga Samyutta. Bojjhanga means the enlightenment factors. And this is the enlightenment factors accompanied by loving kindness. It's page 1607 in the Samyutta Nikaya. Verse number 54:4. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Kalyans, where there was a town of the... how do you say that? Kolyan? C-O-L-I-Y-A-N.
Kolyan.
Okay, Kolyan. Then in the morning, a number of monks, dressed and taking their bowls and robes, entered the town for alms. Then it occurred to them, it is still too early for alms. Let's go to the park of the wanderers of other sects. In all of the towns, they had meeting places for the ascetics. And quite often it was in a park, but it would have a roof over it, things like that, so you'd stay out of the rain, but you could still discourse with people with different ideas. Then those monks went to the park of the wanderers of other sects. They exchanged greetings with those wanderers, and when they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, sat down at one side. The wanderers then said to them, "Friends, the ascetic Gotama teaches the Dhamma to his disciples thus. Come, monks, abandon the five hindrances, the corruptions of mind that weaken wisdom, dwell pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, the fourth quarter, thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to oneself. Dwell pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without ill will. Dwell pervading one quarter of a mind imbued with compassion, likewise the second, like the third and the fourth, thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to oneself. Dwell pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with compassion, vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without ill will. Dwell pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with altruistic joy. Likewise, the second, the third, and the fourth, thus above, below, and across, and everywhere, and to all as to oneself. Dwell pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with altruistic joy. Vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without ill will. Dwell pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with equanimity. Likewise, the second quarter, the third, and the fourth. Thus above, below, across, and everywhere. and to all as to oneself. Dwell pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with equanimity, vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without ill will. We too, friends, teach the Dhamma to our disciples thus. Come, friends, abandon the five hindrances, and it goes through the whole thing again. So, what here is the distinction? What the disparity, the difference between the ascetic Gotama and us? That is, regarding the one Dhamma teaching and the other, regarding the one manner of instruction and the other. Then those monks neither delighted nor rejected the statements of those wanderers. Without delighting in it, without rejecting it, they rose from their seats and left, thinking, "We shall learn the meaning of this statement in the presence of the Blessed One." So rather than get in some kind of a verbal conflict and trying to explain it to each other, they were silent. They just, okay, we'll find out, maybe get back with you later, like that. Then when those monks had walked for alms, and return from the alms round after their meal, they approached the Blessed One. Having paid homage to him, they sat down at one side and reported to him the entire discussion between those wanderers and themselves. And the Blessed One said, "Monks, when wanderers of other sects speak thus, they should be asked, 'Friends, how is the liberation of mind by loving kindness developed? What does it have as its destination, its culmination?'" Friends, how is the liberation of mind by loving kindness developed? What does it have as its destination, its culmination, its fruit, its final goal? How is the liberation of mind by compassion developed? What does it have as its destination, its culmination, its fruit, its final goal? How is the liberation of mind by altruistic joy developed? What does it have as its destination, its culmination, its fruit, its final goal? How is the liberation of mind by equanimity developed? What does it have as its destination, its culmination, its fruit, its goal? Being thus asked thus, those wanderers would not be able to reply, and further they would meet with vexation. For what reason? Because they would not be within their domain. I do not see any monk in the world with its devas, maras, and brahma, in this generation with its ascetics and brahmins, its devas and humans, who could satisfy the mind with an answer to those questions except the Tathagata or a disciple of the Tathagata or one who has heard it from them. And how, monks, is the liberation of mind by loving kindness developed? What does it have as its destination, its culmination, its fruit, its final goal? Here, monks, a monk develops the enlightenment factor of mindfulness accompanied by loving kindness. Okay, and it goes through the whole thing. The enlightenment factor of investigation of your experience, the enlightenment factor of energy. Now, all of these are accompanied with loving kindness. The enlightenment factor of joy, of tranquility, of collectedness, of equanimity. Okay, the enlightenment factor of equanimity accompanied by loving kindness based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, maturing in release. If he wishes, may I dwell perceiving the repulsive in the unrepulsive. And what is that saying? When you see things that are not repulsive, you don't go out and grab after them. So you're repulsing it. You're not getting involved with it. He dwells perceiving the repulsive therein. If he wishes, may I dwell perceiving the unrepulsive as repulsive. That's just still is talking more about keeping balance in your mind. He dwells perceiving the unrepulsive therein. If he wishes, may I dwell perceiving the repulsive in the unrepulsive and in the repulsive. He dwells perceiving the repulsive therein. If he wishes, may I dwell perceiving the unrepulsive in the repulsive and the unrepulsive. He dwells perceiving the unrepulsive therein. If he wishes, avoiding both the unrepulsive and the repulsive, may I dwell equanimously, mindful and clearly comprehending. Then he dwells therein, mindful and clearly comprehending. Or else he enters and dwells in the deliverance of the beautiful. The deliverance of the beautiful is talking about getting into the fourth jhana and experiencing the fourth jhana. Now, one of the reasons that everybody thinks that loving kindness only goes to the third jhana is because you can only feel it here. But you get into the fourth jhana, you don't feel it anymore. And you start radiating from your head, and they don't see that. So they say, well, you can only get to the third jhana with this practice. When in fact, you both know that's not true. The liberation of mind by loving kindness has the beautiful as its culmination, fourth jhana. I say for a wise monk here who has not penetrated to a superior liberation. And how, monks, is the liberation of mind by compassion developed? What does it have as its destination and culmination, its fruit and its final goal? Here, monks, a monk develops the mindfulness factor of enlightenment accompanied by compassion. And then you go through all of the enlightenment factors again. Based upon seclusion, dispassion, cessation, maturing in release. If he wishes, may I dwell perceiving the repulsive and all of that stuff. May I dwell equanimously, mindful and clearly comprehending. When he dwells therein, equanimously, mindful and clearly comprehending, or else with the complete transcendent of perceptions of form, with the passing away of perceptions of with the passing away of perceptions of gross sensory impact. Right? Yeah. With the non-attention to perceptions of diversity. And that sentence has got to be taken out. That's all there is to it. Because there is attention to perceptions of change. And they're saying there's non-attention to it, and that can't be. Aware that space is infinite, He enters and dwells in the base of the infinity of space. Monks, the liberation of mind, guide, compassion has the base of the infinity of space as its culmination. I say for a wise monk here who has not penetrated to a superior liberation. In other words, you haven't gone on. So, it's saying right here that compassion is experienced in the arupa jhana of infinite space.
What is compassion, though? I don't know the difference between compassion and loving kindness.
Keep practicing. Tell me when you see a change in the feeling. And I'm not talking about location. I'm talking about quality of the feeling. And how, monks, is the liberation of mind by altruistic joy developed? What does it have as its culmination, its destination, its fruit, its final goal? Here a monk develops the enlightenment factor of mindfulness accompanied by joy and accompanied by all of the others, and the enlightenment factor of equanimity accompanied by joy. Based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, maturing in release. If he wishes, may I dwell perceiving the repulsive in the unrepulsive. If he wishes, avoiding both the unrepulsive and the repulsive, may I dwell equanimously, mindful, and clearly comprehending. Then he dwells therein equanimously, mindful and clearly comprehending. Or else by completely transcending the base of the infinity of space, aware that consciousness is infinite. He enters upon and abases and dwells in the base of the infinity of consciousness. The liberation of mind by altruistic joy has the base of the infinity of consciousness as its culmination. I say for a wise monk here who has not penetrated a superior liberation. So we're talking about when you get to a certain depth in your practice and your mind becomes calm, then the feeling of loving kindness changes to a feeling of compassion, and then you start feeling the infinity of space. As your mind becomes even more calm, then the feeling of compassion changes to a feeling of joy. This is not the same kind of joy that you're used to. And you start seeing individual consciousnesses arising and passing away. And this is at all of the sense doors. But it's most easily seen through the eyes, because about 85% of our senses is really through our eyes. And that's not to say you won't see it at the other sense doors. You will. But this one you really notice much more easily. And how, monks, is the liberation of mind by equanimity developed? What does it have as its destination, its culmination, its fruit, its final goal? Here, monks, a monk develops the enlightenment factor of mindfulness accompanied by equanimity. And then you go through all of those. And the enlightenment factor of equanimity accompanied by equanimity. And this is where equanimity gets very strong. Based upon seclusion, dispassion, cessation, maturing in release. If he wishes, may I dwell with the repulsive and the unrepulsive. If he wishes, avoiding both the unrepulsive and the repulsive, may I dwell equanimously, mindful, and clearly comprehending. Then he dwells therein, equanimously, mindful, clearly comprehending, or else by completely transcending the base of infinity of consciousness, aware that there is nothing. He enters and dwells in the base of nothingness. Monks, the liberation of mind by equanimity has the base of nothingness as its culmination. Okay, that's as high or deep as the Brahma Viharas will take you. Now, when you start looking at those spaces in between the consciousnesses, then you'll start noticing that mind is not looking outside of itself anymore. And there's nothing. But there's still stuff. Now, this is where you really get to fine-tune your energy. When the feeling of joy changes to the feeling of equanimity, and you're radiating that equanimity in all directions at the same time, and without any boundary or limits, that is your object of meditation. But you will notice that you still have the five aggregates, you still have the enlightenment factors, you can still have and be knocked out of the jhana if your mindfulness isn't sharp enough. And you will experience joy, or not joy, restlessness, or dullness of mind, depending on the amount of energy you're putting into watching. It's real important now to keep adjusting the energy little bit by little bit. And what I mean by that is the energy you're putting into watching. Okay, as you're observing, if you put a little bit too much energy into it, you get restless. And it's not just restlessness that comes up. There's the dislike of it. So you get to work with that for a little while, but you let go very quickly. And what you're teaching yourself now is to really, really have strong balance. And you're teaching yourself more and more about how to use the six R's automatically to adjust things. And when it starts happening by itself, then you'll go deeper. Now, the reason that you only go to the realm of nothingness with the Brahma Viharas is because that's as far as feeling goes. And the Brahma Viharas is a feeling meditation. Now you get into a space where you're sitting and you think, I've been sitting for a long time and it seems like I've been asleep. Is it possible to sit really, really still and still be asleep? But when you come out of that, you start reflecting on what happened while you were in that state. And there's still things that are happening. And as you reflect, you'll start to see how your automatic habit of the six R's starts to take over, and you don't become involved with if there's lights or other things that I don't want to talk too much about it, especially with as active a meditation as your imagination comes with. But there will be the reflecting and the realizing, ah, this is what was happening then. And how your mindfulness in the 6 hours just released it and relaxed and continued. Now, when you get into the upper arupa jhanas, your mind is getting into vibration, not movement so much. As you go deeper in that, the vibration becomes less and less. And when you get to neither perception nor non-perception, one of the amazing things that happens is before you felt everything expanding, now you feel it getting smaller and smaller and smaller until you can't really tell whether it's there or not. There's slight vibration, slight movement of mind, but you keep relaxing. See, that's the whole thing with the 6 hours. That relaxing step that took you from your mind doing this and flip-flopping all over the place to being able to see slight, tiny movements. And eventually, you'll get to a place where it stops. You'll be in that state for a period of time. It's just like somebody flips the lights off. Just stops. When the perception and feeling come back, that's when you see the links of dependent origination in the Four Noble Truths. And you see the cessation of all of that. And it's such a big oh wow that your mind goes into the unconditioned. When you let go of that last bit of ignorance, how can you talk about there being anything else arising? It's just an unconditioned state. So, this is what we're after. This is what we're working for. But you will experience joy like you've never experienced before. And you come and you say, Bhante, I just had this experience, and I get you to talk about it, and then they say, yeah, okay. Go sit. Continue.
Bring the energy back up.
Oh, you don't need it back up. You need to balance it now, because it's really strong. And it's very difficult to sit at that time. But I don't care. You got to go sit. You have experienced the path knowledge. And what I'm interested in is having you experience not only the path knowledge, but the fruition knowledge. Now, when the fruition occurs, it can happen fast, but for most people that I've seen, it doesn't happen right away. Okay, one of the reasons I tell you to go sit is to see whether it can happen for you. But you start becoming much more aware of dependent origination and everything, and you start seeing it, and you wouldn't consider breaking a precept. You want to keep your mind as pure as possible. So you let go of a lot of your old habitual ways of thinking and doing things, and now you start doing a more wholesome kind of way. And you can be washing the dishes, you can be taking a bath, and all of a sudden, you feel it starting to come on again. You feel your mind starting to go deep. So you stop what you're doing, you go sit. And there are four steps of enlightenment. If you see dependent origination arise and pass away one time, that means you have experienced the fruition of Sotapanna. And with the fruition of Sotapanna, there is personality change. You never again believe that anything is personal. You see everything as being an impersonal process. You don't ever have any doubt arising as to whether this is really the right path or not. You know that it's the right path. You completely let go of any ideas that rites and rituals will lead to Nibbana. Okay, those are the major changes that happen in your personality. Your personality starts to get softer. You won't break any precepts on purpose. Now, if you, while you are sitting and you see dependent origination arise and cease two times, very quickly, then you have experienced the fruition of the second stage of enlightenment, Sakadagami. The lust and the hatred are weakened very much. Now, it's a real interesting phenomena that during the time of the Buddha, many people became Sotapannas and Sakadagamis just by listening to what the Buddha was saying and comprehending it. And they might listen to a Dhamma talk and they go back and they start thinking about it and start thinking about how they see these things. He gave a talk on dependent origination and he start looking at dependent origination in everything, and you're teaching yourself how that actually works. You can become enlightened at that time. Doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. Now, if you're sitting and you see the dependent origination arise and pass away three times very quickly, then you have the cessation experience, or the unconditioned experience. When you come back, you'll notice that you have had a major personality change. No lust or hatred of any kind will come up in your mind, no matter what happens to you. It will never come up again. Or, if you're sitting, you can have it arise and pass away four times. If that happens, not only do you experience all of these other fetters that I told you about, you experience the fact that restlessness will never arise again in your mind. Torpor will never again arise in your mind. The desire to experience other realms will never arise in your mind again. Pride, conceit will never arise in your mind again. Now, these are very subtle little things, and also ignorance will never arise in your mind again. Now, these last five fetters are subtle. if you experience the third stage of sainthood, that's being an anagami, you can still have some little traces of pride. It's not that you're, well, I don't know how to explain it exactly. It's not that you're personally attached to it, but you think what you did's pretty good.
Which it is.
There's no getting around it, but there is a slight attachment to the clinging of it.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. So, you can say, well, what's going to happen to me if I have this experience? And my answer is, honestly, I don't know. Well, I don't want to be this. I want to be that. Okay? I have had some students that in past lifetimes they remembered past lifetimes, and in past lifetimes they remembered making a determination to experience this level or that level, and that's what happened. So I have to suspect that this will happen if you make a determination not to go any higher than this level or that level. That determination is very strong, and it will kind of influence it. But you can't ask me, because I don't know. Only guy that knew was the Buddha. He knew that if you continue on this path, you will experience this. But if you stop, you won't experience it. So, this particular sutta is very, very important in helping people let go of wrong views of what the loving kindness is all about. I've said it myself when I was practicing Mahasi Sayadaw's method. Well, loving kindness, it'll only get you into jhana. The loving kindness and the Brahma Viharas lead you directly to nibbana. They don't take you all the way. They lead you up as far as they can go. And then there are some other little tiny attachments that you have to let go of. And when you get into the realm of nothingness, that's when you'll be able to see what happens before mind starts moving. And I'm not gonna tell you. You gotta tell me. So, when I ran across this sutta, I was very shocked by it. And then I started writing to a lot of other teachers that had been telling me the other method and saying, go to this page, look at this page, it's 1607, go there and read that. And now there are teachers that are teaching absorption meditation, but they're talking about Samatha Vipassana. That's what I teach, Samatha Vipassana. They don't have the definition very good yet. But it's finding these kind of suttas and showing where there has been some wrong thinking along the way is starting to open up a lot more of people's thinking. And of course, there's going to be some people that are attached, and some people that will still criticize, but that's theirs. I don't care. One of the things that Kema is continually amazed by is how much courage I have to come out and say, I know you've been practicing this way for 35 years, but look at that. But I can't help myself. And it's ingrained. I want everybody to be able to experience a lot of the things that I've experienced through meditation, and I know that they can. So I'm real anxious to correct some wrong thinking. Now, what's the difference between constructive criticism and criticism? Tell me.
Constructive helps a person get to the right place. Criticism seems to be just more negative.
Well, that's a yes and a no. What do you think?
What came to my mind was constructive criticism has compassion and loving kindness motivating it.
Yes. Yes, there is that, but also it is more impersonal. Okay, constructive criticism is an impersonal process. That means that there's no emotion behind it. So what you're saying is, you've been practicing this way for a long time. I just found in the sutta that it says this. Do with it what you will. Now that's constructive criticism. And it's not politically correct to come out and say something like that. Because politically correct means trying to agree with everybody no matter what, and it doesn't happen. So we have to be able to be open enough not to get emotional. And if we can stay balanced when we show other people these things, they'll start to hear it over a period of time. And that's, I've been back in this country 9 years, and that's what's starting to happen. People are starting to actually listen, and I run across teachers every now and then that have been teaching the Arupa Jhanas in absorption, and I show them this kind of stuff and say, there's another way, you ought to look at it. So, we'll wait and see. One of the things that Usila Nanda impressed upon me when I first started practicing and being his attendant and that sort of thing was, don't grow fast. Grow slowly. Get a good foundation. And then everything will take off by itself. But that's what I've been trying to do in the last 9 years. I've had opportunities to be at other places where there was a lot of people that would listen to me, but it would be like a flash in the pan. And what I want is people that are really ready and willing to come and go through the changes and see this stuff is real. And then when you go back out into your society, you can show other people how real it actually is. And that's the only way I can see Dhamma lasting in this country. We have people that they love being therapists and going to the end of whatever the pain is that's causing me my upset. But that's not really letting it go. Why? Because there's still tension and tightness there. So, eventually, over a period of time, many people will start to catch it.